Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour editorial review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on story time. When we come back. You know, once in a while we get a glimpse of the real world through the eyes of an insider like John Swinton, for instance. Now, Swinton was the guest of honor at a banquet that was given to him by the leaders of his craft, and someone who didn't know John Swinton, nor the press, offered a toast to the independent press. Well, Swinton outraged his colleagues by replying that there's no such thing at this date of world history in America as an independent press. Now, you know it, and I know it. Now, he made the statement in 1880. Now, he's went on to say that there's not one of you who dares to write your honest opinions, and if you did, you know beforehand it would never appear in print. And I'm paid weekly for keeping my honest opinions out of the paper that I'm connected with, and others of you are paid similar salaries for similar things, and any of you who would be so foolish as to write your honest opinions would be out on the streets looking for another job. And if I allowed my honest opinions to appear in one issue of my paper before 24 hours, my occupation would be gone. He said the business of the journalist is to destroy the truth, to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, and to sell his country and his race for his daily bread. You know it and I know it, and what folly is this toasting an independent press? He said, we're the tools and vassals of rich men behind the scenes. We're the jumping jacks. They pull the strings and we dance. Our talents, our possibilities, and our lives are all the property of other men. We are intellectual prostitutes. That sounds like Brian Williams and Katie Couric and Charlie Gibson, doesn't it? Now, when we talk about these paid minions of the press, these rich men behind the scenes that control them, are the real movers and shakers of the Global 2000 program and the New World Order, men and families like the Windsors and Rockefellers and Bushes and Bundys and Carnegies and Vanderbilts. So that's why I say it's time to wise up and start listening more to the God of Abraham and stop following after all these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians, and let's prepare to live through and survive this New World Order and Global 2000 insanity. Now, if you'd like to learn more about Global 2000 and Bible prophecy, this New World Order, call and order my free 4-hour compact disc package. It's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative. Best of all, it's free, and you can call right now and order one. The number's 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email when you get there, the email machine, and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, it's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about story time this week, and I've related to you two or three stories, you know, that I've picked up in my career. And I thought I'd tell you a story here about a guy that was, he used to live down in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and I can't remember his name now. He was an old man in his 80s when he came here to school, came to tax school. And he hadn't filed or paid his taxes for some time. You know, he'd been to some of those patriot meetings or right-wing reactionary groups, and they told him the income tax is voluntary, or they told him that he was a straw man, or that, you know, some of this other nonsense that goes around, you know, in these pseudo-legal circles. And so anyway, he came up here, he had a lien on his property. Now, this old man had worked all of his life, just he and his wife. They had one son. He's 85 years old, or 87 years old, and he's got 6 houses in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and he has 20 acres in Florida. All of it's free and clear. He bought and paid for all of it. Through the course of his lifetime, his wife was still alive and active, and he was alive and active. He was in good health. They had a $27,000 lien against these 6 houses. The IRS didn't know about his 20 acres over in Florida. And here he is in the classroom, and he told his story, and I listened patiently, and he got all through with his story, and he was really adamant. The IRS was a bunch of dirty no-goods, and they were breaking the law, and they were violating the Constitution, and they were just doing all these bad, wicked, terrible, awful things to him and everybody else in America, and so he was just really bummed out. When he got through, and I said, well, sir, it appears to me that you don't really have a tax problem. What you really have here is a business problem. And I pointed out to him that the rents on his 6 houses, now actually he had 7 houses, he had 6 rental units, and that's what they had the liens on. For some reason, they didn't have a lien on his house, the 7th unit over here. I don't know why. They either didn't know about it, or maybe he had it in a trust, or maybe his son owned it. I don't remember exactly how that deal came down, but they didn't have a lien on the 20 acres in Florida. And I told him, I said, well, the reason they don't have a lien on the 20 acres in Florida is because they don't know about it. If they knew about it, they'd have a lien on it. And he was trying to sell the 20 acres in Florida. Now, the funny part of this was that the piece of property in Florida, 20 acres, he had for sale for $600,000. And the six houses that he had over here in Baton Rouge were worth about $100,000 apiece. Now, this is back in the '80s when $100,000 house was a pretty good chunk of change. You know, today, you know, you got these $200,000, $300,000, $500,000 houses. It kind of blows your mind. You know, for if you're sold as I am, the idea of a $500,000 house, you know, is just preposterous. But then, that's inflation. And so I pointed out one other thing. I said, now, sir, rent is income by definition. So when you're renting this house over here for $300 a month, that $300 a month is income. And so you need to pay your income tax on that income. And of course, he was a little bit surprised because, you know, he thought I was a tax protester. And he came here to school because he wanted to learn how to be a bigger, better tax protester than I was. And I'm not really a tax protester, and I never have been. And I know I've been accused of that. You know, people have accused me of being a Nazi, a communist, a socialist, a Republican, a Democrat, and I'm not any of those things either, even though I've read Mein Kampf and the 10 Planks to the Communist Manifesto. I deny that I'm a communist or a Nazi. But nevertheless, I've been accused of that a couple of times. And so I said, now, without getting into the ins and outs of this thing called the income tax, the problem that you have is that you've got this $27,000 lien against your six houses, and you're about to have a $27,000 lien applied to your $600,000 Florida property, and they're going to include anything else you've got over here if they possibly can. And then since you're over 70 years old, they're not going to prosecute you, sir. And the IRS could prosecute you when you're 105 years old, but they don't. They don't prosecute. They have a policy. They don't prosecute you when you get to be 70. Now, I know somebody's going to say, yeah, but they prosecuted Irwin Schiff. Well, there's exceptions to the rule, and I think Irwin probably fit the exception pretty well. But as a general rule, once you get to be 70 years old, they're not going to prosecute you for tax evasion. What they're going to do is put a lien on your property, wait until you die, and then take it and divide it among themselves. That's the way that game is played. And I said, now, did you have it in mind that you were going to leave all of your property to your son? And he said, yes, that's what I want to do. And then when I told him that the IRS wasn't going to prosecute him, that they were just going to wait patiently until he died, and then they would run this out, and nobody would know how to get the IRS liens off, and then they ultimately would take the property or some of it or most of it or half of it or something. And see what the IRS does. They know that you're going to hire a lawyer. And then as soon as you hire a lawyer, that lawyer works for the government. Did you know that? I've covered that a time or two in here. So when you hire an attorney, he becomes your guardian. And then you give him your power of attorney. Then he's working for the IRS, and the IRS is working with him to deprive you of the property. I mean, that's the way the game is played. So in case you didn't know, now you do. All right, so the old man was just livid. I mean, he was jumping up and down, pawing the ground, biting the bushes with the thought that these IRS agents were going to take his life's work and ace his son out and over this $27,000. So I said, sir, do you have $27,000? And he said, yes, I do. I said, okay. Now, I pointed out to him, I said, no, sir, I'm not a lawyer, and I cannot give you legal advice. Oftentimes people will call here at the law school, and they'll say, well, now, Mr. Gordon, you're a pretty knowledgeable guy, and I need your advice. And I tell him, well, that's real good of you, and I'm flattered, but... But you see, the legal profession, like the medical profession, and in fact, like all professions, all 15 of them, those are regulated enterprises that are owned by your government. And so I can't give you medical advice. You know, if you walked in here and you said, oh, I don't feel real good, and I said, oh, my God, you're dehydrated. You need a glass of water here. See, that would be a diagnosis. I'm diagnosing you as being dehydrated. And then I'm prescribing a remedy, which is a glass of water, to cure the dehydration. Now, that's a crime. You can't do that unless you're a medical doctor. I don't make these rules. I don't make these laws. I'm just reporting to you. That's the way it is. So I'm very careful about prescribing and diagnosing the medical conditions like dehydration. And the same thing is true with law. You know, I can teach law, but I can't advise people. So a lot of times people get confused right there, and they don't quite understand that. I know it isn't logical. I mean, if you're a truck driver driving down the road listening to this, you're sitting there saying, that's stupid. I agree. There's a lot of things that go on in life that are really stupid, but then I don't make these stupid laws. I just got here in 1939, and I have to live with these stupid laws just like you do. And I have to make my way through the maze and see if, like any other rat, I can get into the cheese, you know, into the center of the maze. So I pointed out to him I couldn't give him legal advice, but I said, I could tell you what my opinion is. And that comes under free speech. You see, under the First Amendment, I have a right to free speech. So I could say, well, you know, here's what little Georgie Gordon thinks. Now, here's what little Georgie Gordon would do. Or here's what I knew an old guy one time years ago, and he had a very similar problem. Here's what he did. So I could do that. I can suggest to him a couple of alternatives. And I said, if you owe somebody $27,000 and you go in and pay him, he no longer has a claim. That lien has to be released, you see. And I said, now you got to handle this lien release very, very carefully, because I knew a guy one time, and he had an IRS lien. And he went in and paid it, but they never took the lien off. Didn't take the lien off. They left the lien on. He paid them, and they were supposed to take the lien off, but they didn't. And then he died. The IRS came in there and executed the lien. So I said, now, if I was doing this, I would go down with the $27,000 check, and I would put it on the counter, and I'd keep my hand on it. And then I would insist that they have a $27,000 lien release, and the IRS guy, he's got his hand on it. And then you slide your check over, and he slides that lien release over, and then you let your hand off of the check, and then he lets his hand off of the lien release, and then you put your hand on the lien release, and he puts his hand on the check, and the transaction is made. And you've got the lien release in your grubby little fist. Don't ever walk out of an IRS office without having the lien release in your grubby little fist. I said, now the transaction's made. I said, then what you could do, and I've seen people do this before, I said, what you could do then is that you could go about selling your properties, because you see, there's no claim on your properties, and there isn't going to be a claim on your property until the next tax season, the next April the 15th. And like as not, if you're paid up, they won't even come after you for about 3 years. They typically wait when you don't file. They don't come after you the first year. They typically wait for 3 years. That's been my observation. And I said, you'd have anywhere from 12 to 36 months, 12, 24, 36 months before you get back to where you have another lien on this property again. So you're going to be, you know, you're going to be free and clear here for about 36 months. I'll give you 3 years to sell all of your property. And I said to him, I said, look, you're 85 years old, sir. You're going to die. You understand that, don't you? You're going to die. And probably sooner rather than later, because the average lifespan is 75 and you're already 85. You know, you've already got your 4 score. I mean, you know, you've collected your 3 score and 10 plus a little. You know, you're a free agent, son. You're gonna die here. And you want to leave this to your children. Now, if you leave this to your children with a will, you know, a lot of people, you know, they like to get a will. Have you ever wondered where the idea of wills came from? Did you ever look at 2 Hezekiah 14:4 in the Bible? 2 Hezekiah 14:4, and you'll learn all about wills in the Bible. I'm just kind of kidding you here a little bit, because you see, there's an inheritance law in the Bible, and 2 Hezekiah isn't one of the books of the Bible. He's just kind of jerking your chain there. And this idea of wills and probate is a Roman civil law methodology whereby members of the legal profession transact your property among themselves and take part of it. Now, they don't take all of it. They just take a third. And it's called the inheritance tax. And so the government comes along with this inheritance tax thing. Say, God, the creator, you know, the God of Abraham, he didn't come up with this will and probate program. That was something that was dreamed up, you know, years and years ago by lawyers who insist, and they constantly lobby you and talk to you about, don't, whatever you do, don't die without a will. And that's because the lawyer can come in and then take a third of your estate if you've got a will, but if you don't have a will, he can't come in and take a third of your estate. And so the lawyers over here aren't dumb. It makes all the sense in the world that you'd make up a will so that you can cut somebody in the legal profession in, because see, the members of the legal profession don't work. That's right, they don't work. And if they worked, they could make a living. We call this an honest living, you know, driving a truck, you know, electricians, plumbers, carpenters, workers. And since they don't work, then somebody else has to work and produce all of their food and fiber and housing and everything else, because lawyers don't build houses and they don't cut lettuce. You know, so, but they eat lettuce and they live in houses. So these lawyers, they have to have, you know, a lawyer is like a tick in a dog's ear. It just drives them plumb nuts. You know what I mean? Just drives them plumb nuts. And they live off of, they suck the blood out of other people. And government agents do the same thing. And the reason I say that is because, see, government agents don't produce anything. Government agents don't produce any meat, milk, butter, and eggs. I mean, you don't have a Department of Agriculture over here with a bunch of people, you know, working for the government out here producing meat, milk, butter, and eggs and wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil to put out in the marketplace for you people to buy. Those people are bureaucrats. All they do is go out here and raise hell with farmers and get in their way so that the farmer can't produce as much meat, milk, butter, and eggs and wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil as he normally could. They call those OSHA, EPA, State Tax Commission, and so on. I always preferred doing business with the mafia. I've never done business with the mafia, but if I was going to do business with a government agent or the mafia, I would always pick the mafia. Because, see, when a mafia man comes into your store, and he's rude, he's surly, he's nasty, you know, he doesn't smile, and he says, you need protection. And so you say, why do I need protection, sir? And he says, because if you don't have protection, your store's going to burn down. And you say to the mafia man, well, why, sir, do you think my store's going to burn down? Because you didn't pay your protection, he says. How much is this protection? He says, it's $100 a week, and I come in every Wednesday. And what happens if I don't pay you this protection? He says, your store's going to burn down, just like the one up the street. He didn't have protection. His store burned down. So, you know, if you're living in New York or Philadelphia or someplace, you know, you say, oh, I think I understand how this game is played. So you reach in the cash drawer, and you pull out a $100 bill, and you give it to him, and he leaves. But he doesn't come in and take your office and audit your payroll journals. He doesn't come in here and raise hell with your customers. He takes the $100 and he leaves. He goes away. He'll be back next Wednesday. But if you're dealing with OSHA, the EPA, or some government agent, he not only comes in and demands the extortion. Well, he doesn't take the $100 bill out of your cash drawer. He takes that every April 15th in your income tax. Or he collects when you deliver your payroll deductions to the bank every quarter, you see. But the government agent, rather than taking the money and then getting the hell out of your way so that you can spend the rest of the week working and making money so that you can pay your protection, he stays there in your store and he raises hell with your customers. tries to drive your customers away. And he raises hell with your suppliers and threatens with liens and takes your office to audit your books. And he just gets in the road so that you can't produce to pay the damn protection. That's the crazy part of it. I had a guy here the other day said you had to have 68 different permits or pieces of paper from different agencies in Los Angeles to build a house. Now you talk about getting in the way. So that's why I always said I'd rather do business with the mafia than do business with a government agent. But anyway, getting back to the guy's story over here, I said, now, if you would sell all of your property and convert that into $100 bills, and then take your $100 bills and convert that into gold, and then take the gold and divide it into 10 portions, and then go out into the swamps of Louisiana and bury your 10 stashes of gold at your advanced age, take your son with you so that your son will know where these 10 stashes of gold are. And then the government agents won't know where your 10 stashes of gold are, so they can't get their hands on them. And I said, it's just a good business principle that you never leave the money on the table. Because if the money's on the table, then it's vulnerable. It can be taken by somebody else. But if you take all the money off the table, then it's not vulnerable. I said, then you can go back home in your one house that is not leaned, you see. And then you can live your life in this one house that isn't leaned. And if I was you, I'd sell that one too and then go rent an apartment someplace if it was me. But then, you know, I don't know exactly what he did with his house, the one he was living in. So he called me up. It was about a year or so later. I don't know. He called me up and he said, Mr. Gordon, he said, I've sold everything. I said, you did? He said, yes, sir, I sold everything. And he said, I converted it all to gold and I buried it in swamps with my son. And he said, now I can die in peace. I said, now, sir, when you sold all of this, you made quite a profit, no doubt, and you probably owe a great big capital gain tax. And he said, oh, I took care of that, Mr. Gordon. I listened very carefully while I was in class. He said, I did. I sold everything for about $1.2 million. And when I got all through, I owed a $300,000 capital gain tax. And I filed my tax return, just like you said. I filed my tax return and I said, I owe you $300,000 and I'm sorry as hell and I'll pay you just as soon as I get it. And I filed it. And I said, now I take it that you didn't pay it, but you filed your tax return. And he said, I did. I said, well, that's what the law requires. You see, the law doesn't require that you pay the $300,000. The law requires that you file a tax return and confess that you owe the $300,000. I remember a guy by the name of Joe Lewis. Old Joe, you know, the brown bomber from the Bronx. Well, old Joe, he made $11 million in his fighting career, and he owed about $3 million in taxes. Well, he had a bunch of people around him over there. I guess Joe couldn't count, none too good, with his shoes on and his hands in his pockets. And so, as a result of that, some of the closer people around him, they'd stolen a lot of money from him, and they didn't pay his taxes for him. They took his money, but they didn't pay his taxes for him. And so, anyway, he owed $3 million. Well, Joe Lewis died. Joe Lewis died, and he died owing the government $3 million. He was never prosecuted for tax evasion or willful failure to file. Joe filed his tax returns. He says, I owe you $3 million, and I'm sorry as hell, and I'll pay you as soon as I get it. Old Joe checked out owing the government $3 million. That's not against the law. That's not against the law. But owing the government money and not filing your tax return and fessing up, not going to confession. And that's what April 15th is. It's confession day. Now, that's against the law. And so you make sure that you file your tax returns. And so the old man, I imagine he's dead. That was 20 years ago. I imagine the old man is dead now and buried, and I think about him every once in a while, and I just thought I'd tell you about the old man from Baton Rouge with the six houses and 20 acres. While we're on the subject of old men, there was an old man I knew by the name of Pat Connolly. I say old because, you know, he was about my age, you know, 20 years ago or so, 25. And Pat, he had a house out on Eustick Road up in Boise, Idaho. It was an old farmhouse. And on 7 acres. Old Pat lived out here. You know, remember, he was the printer. I told you this story, I think, the other day. Pat was the printer at Postal Instant Press up there at Fairview and Orchard, you know, for years. And he retired from the Postal Instant Press business, and he put some machinery in his garage and lived his life happily ever after without employees. And he was always dealing under the table, you know, in cash money. It was, oh, I'm sure he paid his taxes every year. I don't doubt for a minute that old Pat, I don't think that he would fail to file and pay his taxes. You know, even though he was getting paid in $20 bills and he was working under the table, I'm sure he was honest, paid his taxes. But he had a deal come down one time that's worth learning a lesson about. He had this house on 7 acres. Now, he's got a well and a septic tank on this property over here. This old farmhouse has been here, you know, since the Garden of Eden. It's been here forever. Well, anyway, old Pat buys this place, and he's lived in here, you know, for 20 years or so. And this is back in the 1980s. This is about 1978, 79, 80, long in there. Now, it's close to Boise, and the developers, the builders, you know, have been buying up all these 20-acre fields and building houses out here, you know, on their steady march to Meridian. I imagine by now they're probably out to Meridian, maybe on their way to Caldwell. But they were eating up all the farmland, you know, out there around Boise. And so old Pat, you know, he had the 7 acres out there that was a part of a big farm at some time in the past. And now it had all been built up with houses. And so they built a LID. They voted in a LID. And a LID is a limited improvement district, LID, a little government agency of some kind. I'm not exactly sure how it works, but it's a little taxing department or agency. And this LID was for the purposes of providing sewer and water. I don't know if it was a part and parcel of the Boise City Council or what it was. But anyway, they had the power to levy taxes. And so they came up and down Eustick Road. And all of the old timers that were there, they said, you have to hook up to the sewer. And you got to hook up to the water. See, they put in sewer and water up and down Eustick Road for all of these subdivisions, you know. Now, you know, if you're going to put thousands of houses out here, you know, in the pasture, you got to have some way to dispose of all that doo-doo, you know, that George Bush used to talk about being in deep doo-doo. So had to have a way to dispose of it. So they call that a sewer district, a limited improvement district, and they form it for sewage. But they came around to the old-timey guys that were actually grandfathered in, had been there for years and years, you know, people that owned 5 acres or 10 acres or 7 acres like old Pat did. And intimidated these people into hooking up to the sewer district. Well, you know, when the Ranger Rick comes along and they send you letters and they come from lawyers and scares the living hell out of everybody, you know. And so they don't want to join. They've got a septic tank and they've got a well and they don't need the water and they don't need the sewer and they don't want it. But they're intimidated. They don't know what else to do, you know. And then some guy knocks on their, it's the law! You see, and they tell you it's the law and so you don't know. And hell, if you go hire a lawyer, he'll probably be working for the other side and taking your money in. And then screwing you over. So that's what happened to Pat. But Pat, you see, had been through the barrister's in school, so he could do legal research. And he's real good with numbers too. You know, Pat was the kind of guy that he could count real good with his shoes on and his hands in his pockets, and he could read real good, you know, and he could look up the law. And he found out that he was grandfathered in, and you couldn't make him hook up to the sewer water district unless you could show that he was in somehow a threat to the health, safety, and welfare of the people or the neighbors around him. That he had some kind of toxic waste or something, you see, that would be a threat. Like having, you know, a bunch of dynamite in your garage. Well, you know, if you've got dynamite stored in your garage, you know, and you're living in a subdivision on a cul-de-sac, you know, that could be construed as being a threat to the health, safety, and welfare of your neighbors, couldn't it? Or if you had radioactive waste, you know, stored in your attic, that could be construed as a threat to your health, safety, and welfare, maybe your neighbors around you. So, you know, you got to be careful, you know, about how that, you know, that all comes down. One thing, and this old Pat, he done a little legal research, you know, to find out what sewage was. And they sent him a letter from the Limited Improvement District, and they said, you are a threat to the health, safety, and welfare of your neighbors. You have sewage. And if you don't dispose of that sewage, which is a hazardous waste product, properly, we are going to prosecute you to the fullest extent of the law. God, that ought to send terror up and down the spines of the strongest men and women of America. All right, pause right here, and I got to tell you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. And if you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website. That's georgegordon.org. Well, our website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed to the webpage as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and the Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. If you like one, just call the Law School at 417-273-4967 and order one. They're free. That's 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the law or an editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, getting back here to our old friend Pat Connolly. Old Pat is sitting in his house in 7 acres. He gets a letter from the LID threatening him with criminal prosecution and civil actions against him if he did not voluntarily hook up to the sewer district. Now, it's going to cost him $330 in those days. In other words, you could call a plumbing contractor out and he'd dig you a hole and hook you up to the sewer out there in the street, you know, for $330 back in those days. But Pat, what did Pat didn't have the $330? It was that He believed that he was a property owner, and he believed in the old American tradition of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness guaranteed in the Constitution. I mean, he was a radical, old Pat was. He's just a nut, you know, believing in the Constitution and things like that. Now, today, you know, if you run around spouting off about the Constitution, you could be construed as a terrorist. They've actually identified people who believe in the Constitution and cite the Constitution to police and so on. As they tell the policemen now, they say, well, these people are probably terrorists. So anyway, this was long before 9/11, and so they weren't calling him a terrorist quite yet, but old Pat now, he'd done a little legal research. In fact, he did a treatise one time on zoning and planning. It's Pat Connolly's treatise on zoning and planning. He researched it all out and wrote up this real neat treatise and got all the cases on it. And he was pretty knowledgeable about zoning and planning and land and property and building permits, you know, and one thing and another. And so as a result of that, he wrote him back a letter and kind of in essence, he said to stick it where there's no daylight. But, you know, he put it in legalese. I mean, he's not a crude fellow, you know, like I am. He was pretty direct and forthright. And he pointed out that he had certain legal rights and that he was grandfathered in and that he was not a threat to anybody. And furthermore, he did not produce any sewage whatsoever. No sewage whatsoever, you know. Now, this is called toxic waste. Sewage is toxic waste. Radioactive material is toxic waste. I mean, you know, there's the garbage is toxic waste. So you can't have garbage. You know, you can't just stick all this garbage out here in your backyard. You know, you can't just, you know, store nuclear waste out here in your backyard. You got to dispose of it properly. Now, most people that have sewage going down their toilets, you know, they call that toxic waste. They call it sewage. You know, Pat said it's not toxic waste and it's not sewage. That's night soil. And he made him an offer. He said, now listen. You people want me to sign up here with the sewer district. He said, I'll do it. He said, but you know, we produce, and I forgot how much it was now, but he said, you know, could pick a number. He says, I produce about 100 gallons of night soil, which is organic fertilizer, and I store it in an underground concrete tank. And I pump it out, and I put it on my land, and I grow my garden and vegetables and one thing and another. And he said, evidently, you'd like to tap in to my night soil, and you want to take it. Now, this is called a taking without due process. This is a taking without just compensation. So I said, if you would pay me $1.40 a gallon for my 100 gallons a day, which would be about $140 a day, 365 days a year, and give me a long-term 20-year contract, he said, I'll hook up the sewage. I will hook up my night soil. I will hook up to your sewer district, and I will sell you my night soil. Now, everybody else around him over here, when they flush their toilets, they produce sewage. Now, Pat, he's got an underground storage tank out here, commonly called a septic tank, but Pat didn't call it a septic tank. He called it a storage tank for his night soil. Now, night soil is human waste that's used for agricultural purposes. You know, people in the Orient, they're very careful about that. They collect all of their human waste, just like their cattle waste and pig waste, and then they compost it and then take it out and put it on the garden. In fact, there's a couple of statutes in the Bible, and Pat pointed this out, that in the Bible, God himself told us to carry a paddle on our sides, and when we go to ease ourselves abroad, that we dig a hole like a cat, and poop in the hole, and then bury it. I know for most of you people, you know, living in the city, this is a wild new concept. The idea that you would take your human waste, dig a hole, and bury it is foreign and alien. I don't deny that. You see, here in America, for you people that live around the world and don't understand, see, a lot of people, you know, live in other countries and they understand that principle of bury your waste in the soil so that the soil microbes will break it down and use it for plant food. And they understand that in China, and they understand that in Japan, and they understand that in Formosa, and they understand that in Indonesia. So here in America, that's a wild, foreign, crazy, unscientific modality. And that's why they reject the Bible, because God tells you the same thing. You know, like all you Chinese people over here, you know, if you got to go to the bathroom, you know, dig a hole, bury it in the ground. Here in America, in case you're wondering, here's what we do. Here in America, we hook this up to what we call a commode. And we put water in this commode, and we hook up pipes to the commode, and we run it out into the street. And so when we have to go to the bathroom, we go get on this thingy over here. We call it a commode, a toilet. And then we ease ourselves into the toilet, and we got a handle up here, and we flush. It's all automatic. We Americans are just nuts for automatic. It's like an airplane, you're flying on automatic pilot. It's all automatic. You just flip the handle, and your poop goes right down this pipe, see, and out into the street, where it goes into a bigger pipe, where it goes down the big pipe, down the street into a bigger pipe, where it goes into a sewage treatment plant, where we run it through all kinds of hoops and haulers over here in pipes, and we spray it, and we douse it with chemicals, and we flush it out into the river, Mississippi River up there in Des Moines. And then we flush this toxic waste, which has now been treated. See, we treat it with chemicals and sprays and dyes, and we flush it down the river so that the people in St. Louis can suck it into their water intake. And then they can drink it and bathe in it, and they can wash their clothes in it, and they can shower in it, and then they can pour some of it into their commodes. And then they can flip the handle, and they can flip their poops down their toilets, and then they can ship it on down the river to the next city, you know, like New Orleans. See how we do that here in America? That's because we're very scientific people. Very scientific. So we flush our waste down the river so that the next city can drink it. So that's strange, you know, for you people in Indonesia, you don't understand that, but, you know, just thought I'd tell you. All right, so my old buddy Pat over here, you know, he says that he doesn't want to give his night soil away because it's valuable for growing vegetables in his garden. Just like, you know, most people would go down to buy some chemical fertilizer to put on their garden. Well, Pat used natural organic fertilizer, including human waste, as despicable as that may sound. Well, I don't know. You know, stop and think about it. You know, if you bury your waste in a hole, and or if you put it in your compost pile, and then it breaks down naturally, just like you know, cow manure, it breaks down naturally, and you spread it on the ground. Then the lettuce plant, the roots eat that up, see, and they convert it into lettuce leaves, and then we eat the lettuce leaves that are made up out of the waste material from cows and humans and others. Now, I think for Americans that's really gross, but for some reason, flushing it down the toilet and out into the river and then sucking it in and drinking it, bathing in it and washing your clothes in it seems to be natural and normal. They don't want to eat the lettuce leaves, but they're willing to shower in it. I don't know. I guess it's just your culture, you know. Well, anyway, there was quite a little tussle going on between the LID and Pat Connolly, and it went on for a couple, 3 years. They never did prosecute him. They never brought suit against him. But they were constantly threatening him. Now everybody up and down the road, they all capitulated. They all joined the Seward District. You know, they didn't want the litigation. Pat was sitting over here waiting for him to arrest him, so he'd have a case to take to the U.S. Supreme Court. He thought this would be a hell of a lark. So this goes on for quite a long time. Meanwhile, the Seward District put a lien against Connolly's property, and this goes on for, I don't know, 8, 10, 12 years. And pretty soon, this lien amounts to $800 against the property. They got a lien against his property. He can't sell his property until this $800 lien is satisfied. Meanwhile, back on the farm, some developer comes along and offers Pat $70,000 for this old farmhouse and 7 acres. That's $10,000 an acre. Now, I know today, you know, you're listening, $10,000 an acre, I'll buy two of them. But $10,000 an acre back about 1980 was just a god-awful bunch of money. And it actually would buy a little bit more than it will today, too. So Pat, you know, being a capitalist and all, and greedy and selfish and all those bad things, he just couldn't turn down. So he said to the developer, he says, you give me $70,000, hell, I'll be out of here by morning. And so they went to the closing. You know how these closing things are, you know, when you're buying a piece of real estate. Anyway, Pat didn't know about this $800 lien. It was on there, and they'd been putting this and adding to this lien, you know, for years against him. I guess there's some bureaucrat down here at this LID said, well, we'll fix this old fart. And so they're putting this lien on here. Pat don't know jack squat about it. And so they go to the closing, and so... At the closing, somebody stands up and says, okay, we got this $800 lien. Pat Connolly has not joined the LID. They've got a lien on there for $800. So they all look over at Connolly like, okay, well, we're not going to give you $70,000, but we're going to give you $69,200. And Connolly said, excuse me, pardon me, but the deal is $70,000. And I'm going to get paid $70,000 or I ain't selling. Now, that's the bottom line to that. Now, not very many people would go to a closing and turn down $69,200 over $800, but Pat would, and he did. He got up and he said, this deal is dead, and walked out. Well, now, when you make a deal, you know, for $70,000 and somebody comes over here and throws water on it, and it looks like Pat suffered damage. So he wrote a letter to the LID and he described his damage. And then he described his disgust with this $800 lien. And he told him in no uncertain terms. He says, now, boys, let's be intelligent about this. You take that lien off and you do it right now. And then you send me a check for $70,000 and you own the 7 acres and you can stick it where there's no daylight. And he said, if you don't, you can rest assured that litigation will surely follow. All right, so you got to give these people 30 days. And so 30 days comes and goes, and the LID over here doesn't budge. So the upshot of it was is that the developer comes over to Pat, and then he says, well, I'll pay you the whole $70,000, and I won't deduct the $800 that comes from it. And Pat said, now, have you made some deal with the LID and you're going to pay them the $800? And he didn't say. So we don't know what the deal was between the developer and the LID. And it was a little disappointing to all of us at Barristers Inn because we were kind of hoping that we could go to litigation over this $70,000 as a taking under the Fifth Amendment and take it through our state courts as a takings action. And then when we got to our state Supreme Court, if we didn't get satisfaction, we'd bump it up to the U.S. Supreme Court and we'd see if we couldn't make some new case law. So the moral of the story is that they went back to a second closing and he got paid the full $70,000, which tells us a little part of the story. If you think you're right, why don't you hang tough? Now, sometimes it's distasteful. And I saw a guy down here in New Orleans, and he was taking the insurance company for fraud to task over lying to him on this Hurricane Katrina hurricane insurance. And he was being interviewed, I don't know if it was on Frontline or 60 Minutes or something, and he said, well, the real bill is they owe me about $250,000. And he said, now they've offered to settle for 180, and he said, I'm almost ready to take the 180 rather than the 250 because they've worn me down. I'm worn down. I'm tired. He'd been in litigation with them now for a couple of years, and Hurricane Katrina was about 2 years ago. And he wants to get on with his life. He's ready to take the 180 and take it in the shorts. Now, the insurance company knows that. See, and they know that if they hang tough for a couple of years, they'll wear you down. Now, the insurance company owes him the full 250. And they're going to stiff him for about $70,000. And they're going to stiff him and thousands of other people for those $70,000, $30,000, $50,000 bills. And they're going to make millions and millions of dollars, even off of the casualty side. I mean, you know, if you owe a guy $1 million and you sell it for $800,000, you just made $200,000, didn't you? And that's the way the insurance companies work. And so I would encourage all of you, hang tough when you're right. And stick it up there, you know what side was. Okay, and with that out of the way, there's the Pat Connolly story. Thought you'd kind of like that one. Now I got 9 minutes left, so left here, so I've got to tell you. And I'll circle off the old man from Baton Rouge here, too. See if I can tell you a short story here in about 9 minutes. I think I probably could. Let me tell you here about old Pat here, 9 minutes. See if I can tell you about Pat Connolly. Get one more story out of old Pat. He, after he sold this place for $70,000, you know, he had some bucks in his pocket. He had a lot, just a building lot on Eustick Road. And he had a farm up at Emmett. And then he had 235 acres up at Emmett. And he wanted to test another legal issue over here. Now, this is a legal issue that was tested. Never went to trial, but evidently everybody agreed with it. So old Pat, he wants to build a house here on this lot, but he wants to build it without a permit. Now, he's in the city of Boise. He's in Boise City, Idaho. He's got to build this house without a building permit. Now, you can't just run out here and start building a house without a building permit. You got to have a thing called good faith. Good faith. And there's a little quirk, at least it was back in the 80s, a little quirk over here. And when you went down to get a building permit, see, you didn't need a building permit if the property or if the building project was under $100. So, you know, if you're gonna put in a new faucet, you know, in your kitchen sink, you know, and the total cost of it's $45, you don't need to go get a building permit. But if the project, you're gonna replace the sink and you're gonna put in a faucet and so on, and the price is $101, well, then you gotta go down and get a plumbing permit or electrical permit, or you gotta go get a building permit or something like that. See, so Pat, he sits down there one day, you know, at the Winchell's Donut House, and he pulls out a napkin and he draws up a house on a napkin, you know. Then he goes down to zoning and planning and he says, "Hey, I'd like to build a house on my lot over here." And they say, "Well, have you got architect's drawings?" And he says, no, I don't have an architect drawing, but I've got it all laid out here on a napkin." And the guy at the zoning and planning people, you know, they said, "Well, you got to be out of your mind. You can't come in here with a napkin. You know, you got to have an architect's drawing." And he said, "Oh, I didn't know that." And he said, "Well, what do I do next?" He said, "Well, you got to go to an architect and have it drawn up." And so Pat said, "Oh, I didn't know." So he went out to a buddy of his who was an architect, and he said, "Hey, Tom, I need an architect drawing. Here's my napkin." He said, "What's this going to cost?" And the architect said, $5,000. And Pat said, "Well, I don't have $5,000. What does a poor person who doesn't have $5,000 do when he needs an architect drawing in order to get a building permit to build a house?" And the architect said, "Well, you know, poor people can't build houses." And Pat said, "Well, I don't know why not. It sounds like discrimination against the poor to me. I mean, you know, if you're a millionaire, you can build a house, but if you're poor, you got to live under a bridge. What the hell is that all about?" And Pat said, no, you can't discriminate against people because they're poor. That's against the law. So he said, "Would you give me a letter? And would you tell me in your letter that if I don't have $5,000, you're not going to give me a print?" And so his buddy Tom did. And so he took the letter down to the zoning and planning people. And he said, "You know, I'm a poor man and I don't have any money and I want to build a house. And I think that this agency has a discriminatory policy against the poor. And the Supreme Court has talked about that in Snyadek versus Family Finance and a number of other cases. And because of that, I think that we need some litigation here." And so they took the napkin into their legal department, and they mulled it over for a while, and they came back and said, "Well, you know, we could give you a waiver here, Mr. Connolly. We probably could take this napkin over here, and we probably could recommend this for a building permit." And so he said, "Why don't you take this over to the building department with this waiver?" So he went over to the building department. He says, "Hey, I need a building permit." And the people at the building permit department said, "Okay, well, fill out this form over here. Here's your waiver. That's good, good." So zoning and planning. So he didn't say now that he wanted to build a 10-story office building here in this residential district and that he needed some kind of a waiver, you know, to build this or city council approval. You know, he's got a lot in a single-family residential neighborhood, and he's just going to build a single-family house. And there shouldn't be any problem over there. Remember, in Los Angeles, you got 68 of these hoops to jump through. Well, in Boise, it wasn't quite 68, but there was 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 9 or 11 or 15, I don't know. But there's something. So you got to follow all these rules and regulations, you see, to show good faith, and so that you've exhausted all of your administrative remedies so that you can get into court so that you can go do something constructive. So the building department gives him the form. He fills the whole thing out. And then the kicker is where it says, "What is the value of this project?" He wrote in $0. You know, I put his name and address and telephone number and put his napkin up here. And here's what I'm going to build. I'm going to build a 3-bedroom, 2-bath house. And I'm going to build it in the ground, and I'm going to do all these neat things. And the guy looks at it and he says, "Well, wait a minute, you can't build a house for no dollars. You have to tell us how many dollars you're going to spend on this house." And Pat said, "I'm poor. I'm going to spend $0. Zero. None. Zip. Zilch. None. Nada. Can you understand? Nothing." And the guy says, "Well, wait a minute. If you're going to build a project that's under $100, then you don't need a building permit." And Pat said, Oh, well, shucks. But he said, "You can't build a house for under $100, sir." And Pat asked him, he said, "Why not?" And he said, well, because the building materials and the carpenters and the plumbers and electricians all cost more than $100. So you're going to have a permit. And to try to build a house for under $100 isn't realistic. And Pat said, why not? And the conversation broke down right about there. Why do I have to spend more than $100 to build a house? Now, you know, that's a legal question. I don't think that there's any law that says that you cannot build a house for $89.40. I mean, I've seen transactions come down with $10 and other good and valuable considerations. I mean, I have personally sold houses for $10 and other good and valuable consideration. So I thought that that was a pretty logical conclusion on Pat's part. Now, it's not Pat's fault that the zoning and planning people and the building departments and the state government agencies over there have written the law in such a way that if you're going to build a house for under $100, you don't need a building permit. Is it? Well, I'm running out of time, and I don't quite have time to finish the story, so let's leave it right there. Pat Connolly is going to build a house for less than $100. I'll see you back here tomorrow night, and then we'll tell you how. Meanwhile, I've got to remind you that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week, and we offer a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the law school at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, we're out of time. We'll have to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.